Welcome to International Law Talk of Wolters Kluwer International Group. During a series of podcasts, we'll bring you insightful analysis, commentary, and discussion from thought leaders and experts on current topics in the field of international arbitration, IP law, international tax law, competition law, and other international legal fields.
Hello, everyone. My name is Max Fischer. I'm the general editor of the Journal of International Arbitration, and it gives me great pleasure to take part in this podcast entitled What Data Tells You About International Commercial Arbitration. Data is the new gold, so the saying goes, and research based on data, as opposed to authors' views or opinions, has become quite a hot topic in recent years. It's called empirical research, and the idea is that it is based on a verifiable and quantifiable source of information. And today's podcast is precisely about such empirical research done in a special issue of the Journal of International Arbitration, recently published, so to speak, hot off the press. And I'm joined today by Monique Sasson, one of the special issue editors. Monique is an independent arbitrator with more of 30 years of experience in international disputes. And before becoming independent, she has worked in major law firms in London, Rome, and New York. So, Monique, very warm welcome to you to this podcast.
Thank you.
So to start, can you tell us why you and your colleagues started this empirical research project and how you structured it?
So thank you very much, Maxi, for also having me here. I, first of all, wanted to thank my colleague who made this research project possible, and above all, you, Maxi, who really made this possible. So I would like to thank Shunsun Fukuda, Zach Gregor, Nikhil Gulati, Anna Kim, and Ariste Zalepuga. And then I wanted to thank Gwen DeVry and Vincent Vershoor at Walter Kluwer. And the last set of thanks are for the ITA Academic Council, and in particular, Professor Joshua Carton, Juditha Cordero-Moss, Jared Wan, and Catherine Rogers. My co-authors, and I should mention them, are Professor Alford, Professor Baltog, and Professor Hall. So why did we think that an empirical research project was needed in commercial arbitration? First, because we saw all the empirical research in investment arbitration, and we saw how important they were and how able they were also to predict where certain arguments would go. We looked at the commercial field. And what we found out was that there was a lot of talk about empirical research, but nobody has done it. Nobody has looked at the data that we have. And this is mainly because we don't have a lot of published data on commercial arbitration. So what is happening in commercial arbitration is that there is mainly anecdotal evidence. And this becomes a sort of unverified and unquantifiable source of information. So everybody just tells their stories, and commercial arbitration becomes a sort of collecting stories from everybody. And of course, by doing that, lots of jurisdictions are left out, because if somebody is not coming to the jurisdiction or to that seminar, so we wouldn't get the story of from certain jurisdiction. So we thought that an empirical research in commercial arbitration was definitely necessary. How did we structure? First of all, what is the data set? So the data set is composed by judgments rendered in set-aside actions, and to be precise, there are 504 judgments there, and 553 judgments rendered in enforcement proceedings. The time frame is 10 years, so from January 2010 to January 2020. And the decision were rendered in 74 jurisdictions. So definitely a big spectrum, although we have to say that 64% of all this decision came from 9 jurisdictions around the globe. And these 9 jurisdictions are Germany, US, Switzerland, Spain, the UK, the Netherlands, France, Brazil, and China. So, of course, we have all this decision. They are the majority of the decisions which are subject of the court judgment of the data set are judgment coming out from awards that were rendered in the context of administered arbitration and not only ad hoc arbitration. So the ad hoc arbitration was just a fraction, so approximately 7%. And the majority were administered arbitration. However, also there we looked at there were over 100 arbitral institutions. So again, a big spectrum of cases. One thing we have to say about the data set is the a couple of bias. So first of all, the data set is the Wolter Kluwer database of all commercial arbitration rendered in these 10 years. We did not have access to other data set first. The second is the selection bias, which means that in this data set, you have practitioners who are selecting the relevant court judgments. So once we looked at this 1,000 judgments, we looked at 1,000 judgments which were initially selected by some practitioners. So, of course, if for one practitioner, for example, for France, he or she doesn't think that a judgment is not relevant, the judgment would not be found on the data set. So on this selection is something on which we have to work more on, and this is, of course, for the future. So the data, again, as we said, are vacatur data and enforcement data. What did we do with that? We simply coded all this judgment on the basis of the arguments raised for the vacatur data by the defendants, and for the enforcement data still by the defendants. The grounds in total were 19 for the vacatur data and 19 for the enforcement data. For the vacatur data, the grounds were based on Article 34 of the Uncitral Model Law, and then we added some grounds such as award not binding, improper venue, no jurisdiction, lack of impartiality, etc. For the enforcement data, we based our coding on Article 5 of the New York Convention. And then also here, we added some grounds such as awards are not in accordance with the procedure of the law of the situs, award not final, enforcement not timely, improper service of process, contract procured by fraud, and also forum non-convenience.
So having done all this incredible work with the data, the exercise of coding it, can you tell us, Monique, about your findings? What are some of the very general conclusions to be drawn from the data?
So one general conclusion is what we expected. So in the majority of the cases, the vacatur application success rate is, as expected, is a low success rate, is 23%, which means that when there is an attempt to set aside an award, only in 23% of the cases the attempt is successful, and in 77% of the cases it's not successful. In enforcement proceeding, the success rate is 73%. Of course, you have to read the enforcement success rate in the opposite way, which means that if it's successful, means that the award has been upheld. Now, the thing that I thought we didn't expect was to have the award upheld in a similar way in vacatur proceeding and in enforcement proceedings. Because if you look at this, the success rate, so award upheld in enforcement proceeding, 70% of the cases. And the same has to be said for set aside proceedings, which means that even if for enforcement we apply the New York Convention and for vacatur we have all the different laws that are applicable in each single jurisdiction, in the end, there isn't such a big difference between the two. So I think this maybe is different from the anecdotal evidence that everybody has, which would have, I would have said probably the opposite, that I would have I would have imagined that the vacatur application success rate would have been much higher. Instead, it's not, it's similar to the enforcement rate. Now, nationalities were many. So we had 104 claimants' nationalities, and it's the same for respondents' nationalities. Who has the largest percentage? The US, as far as claimants are concerned, and also as far as respondents are concerned. The arbitral institution, I thought also that for us was a surprise, that we find that 70% of court proceedings were arising from 110 different arbitral institutions administering arbitral proceedings, which means that there were many arbitral institutions involved there. And probably in, again, if you think about anecdotal evidence, we're always thinking about a handful of arbitral institutions, but there are many there. And actually, you can see that in court judgments. Again, another caveat, 9 institutions administered 48% of the relevant awards. So even if we have a big spectrum, half of it is coming from 9 institutions, which are the usual suspects. So we have ICDR, we have ICC, LCIA, several Brazilian institutions, etc.
So these are all extremely interesting general conclusions. Leaving aside now some of these general considerations, I understand you also looked at some more specific issues. Can you tell us a little bit more what they are?
Yes. So we first looked, we have a general article, which is the one that I wrote with Roger Alf, Corina Baltog, and Matthew Hall about the general conclusion that we reached there. Then we thought that it was important to identify some topics. But again, I mean, what we had in mind was, what is the anecdotal evidence that we have? What is the perception between practitioner about certain arguments that are quite recurrent argument in arbitral proceedings? And so what is coming out from the data on this subject? And then with 3 articles, we looked instead at how was enforcement and setting aside in some geographical area of the world. So we looked at Latin America, China, and France. And I will tell you more in a minute about that. So we have some general topics. So the general topics, the first is what you and Dr. Jensen wrote on invalidity of arbitration agreements and applicable law. And again, there, what we thought was necessary to indicate was about the invalidity of arbitration agreement, because this is a recurrent theme on which a practitioner have always to look at, especially because in this case, what court judgment tells us is what happened to this agreement that then, so there was an arbitration proceeding, and after that, there are court proceedings about them. So we thought that was necessary to look at, and also applicable law. We have to remember that in some jurisdiction, the fact that applicable law was not applied correctly might be an issue also of public policy. So we thought that these two areas were very important. We looked then at the second chapter is about non-signatories. Professor Mistelis and Dr. Rao examined how and when the extension of arbitration agreement to non-signatories was endorsed, upheld in the enforcement of the award, and when it wasn't. This is, again, a very important theme, because with the non-signatory, we have 2 different, almost competing theories, one based on implied consent, one based on equity. And for example, in this case, what the data tells us is that the courts do not look at the theories behind it, but very often they looked at the factual matrix. So they looked at the facts in the case, and then they decide whether based on the facts in the case, it is reasonable or not to extend the arbitration agreement to non-signatory. categories. Again, still on clauses, we looked at pathological clauses because, again, on this we have a lot of stories, sometimes terrible stories, sometimes less terrible, and in any event is an argument that this jurisdictional objection is raised in almost a fifth of the cases. So, of course, it's something that has to be taken care of. When we looked at the data, we realized that what the data tells us is that the construction of a pathological clause is a very narrow construction, and therefore it's very important how you frame the arguments, and that, on the other hand, is even equally important to use standardized clauses in order to avoid lengthy proceedings about something that then in the end might result in nothing, but no matter what, it has been maybe 5 years, depending on which jurisdiction you are, even 10 years, thinking about where I'm coming from, 10 years proceedings. Another topic that we thought was very relevant is conflict of interest. And here we have Dr. Carrara, who addressed this issue on impartiality and independence of arbitrators. Is often a very controversial topic, is been raised in approximately, again, a fifth of the case. However, it's been upheld only in 20% of the cases. Looking at the data, I think if we can give a piece of a tip to practitioners is that it is necessary to raise these objections during the arbitral proceedings rather than after the award is rendered, because in the latter case, it's often viewed as a sort of a partisan, well, you lost it, so it's obvious you're trying to challenge the composition of the tribunal. Professor Baltog looked at enforcement of set-aside awards, and this is very relevant in several jurisdictions. There were several cases in England, in the United States, in the Netherlands that we thought warranted a wider description, and she looked at all of this. Of course, in this jurisdiction, the idea is that there will be, again, an analysis by the tribunal in order to assess if the set-aside proceedings was violating some fundamental principles. I looked at the issue of public policy. Looking at that, why did we decide to look and to choose public policy is mainly because this objection has been raised in almost half of the recognition and enforcement proceedings and in 38% of the setting aside proceedings. So it's a type of catch-all proceedings. So what parties often do in enforcement and set aside proceeding is just to raise public policy. Just at the end of it, in any event, there is always some public policy catch for all provision. The issue with public policy is always to avoid that it really channel a review of the merits of the award. And instead, we saw that the courts looked at fundamental principles and upheld the public policy objection only when there was a breach of fundamental principle. Of course, there are a couple of cases that are not aligned to that. And so, for example, there were a couple of cases saying that the violation of statute of limitation is a violation of public policy. But overall, public policy was the success rate was low and was approximately 20%. But again, since it has been raised in so many cases, it might be more relevant. Then we looked at the enforcement and setting aside in several jurisdictions. And so we looked at that in Latin America by Elina Memerizkmaya. She looked at the most recent jurisprudential approach in Latin America, and especially in Argentina, Colombia, Costa Rica, Chile, Dominican Republic, Mexico, and Peru. And the decision showed the substantial deference towards rulings made by arbitral tribunal. We then look at France. So now one would say, why did you look at France? Because it's definitely a jurisdiction that gets a lot of publicity, and we definitely know a lot about it. We looked at France because our data told us that recognition and enforcement was, so the percentage of recognition, the success rate of enforcement, of recognition and enforcement was lower than in other jurisdictions. That instead, the annulment, the set aside, the success rate was higher than the average in other jurisdiction, the average success rate in other jurisdiction. So we thought, how is it possible in France? So we had Dr. Knoll Tudor, who examined the data and told us that as far as recognition and enforcement, there was a too selective selection bias because the data that were there were too little. And so there were only 10 cases, and it was not a representative sample of the French approach in recognition and enforcement. In part, is because this is an ex parte procedure, so a lot of the what is called the good enforcement doesn't even get in the data because there is no court ruling on that. And in part because what has been selected was just too few decisions. Instead, for setting aside, we noticed that the French court are setting aside with a sort of higher rate of success. And that was also coherent with annulment action in the Paris Court of Appeal, which had success rate similar to what we saw. So was, for example, in 2017, 26%, and was even higher in 2018. So in that, our impression from the data set about what is happening in France was a correct one. On recognition and enforcement, maybe we have to have a caveat. Dr. Dong and Dr. Wan looked at the recognition and enforcement proceeding in China. And I thought that also there it was very interesting because it was in contrast with anecdotal experience. So, for example, out of 37 cases where recognition and enforcement of the award was refused, the public policy defense was upheld only in 3 cases, so 10%, which is far lower than the general upholding of the public policy defense. And instead, what we looked, we saw from the data is that it is very important to look at carefully at service of process. And so that often proceedings and awards were set aside just because service of process was not carried out correctly. And again, another issue that came up in several cases was about the location of the opponent's assets and whether they were located in the court jurisdictions. So the topics were this, again, general and specific. And we thought that they were trying to address what a practitioner would be interested in. So, Maxi, now I'll ask you a question because you wrote a piece dealing, among other things, about the alleged invalidity of arbitration agreement. What were your main discoveries?
So we took all the decisions in the data set and looked at those that dealt with the argument that the arbitration agreement was somehow invalid. For instance, under Article 5.1a of the New York Convention or similar provisions. These were 171 decisions in total. And we divided those in various subcategories depending on the ground a party argued the arbitration agreement was invalid. So, for instance, we distinguished arguments that the arbitration agreement never came into existence or was terminated or was invalid because it did not comply with form requirements or was otherwise violating some mandatory laws or public policy. That latter category is what we called substantive invalidity. And for all these subcategories, we looked at what were in the data set the most frequently invoked grounds and which were the most successful. And that actually led to a couple of surprises. One surprise was about the argument of formal invalidity. It is actually said by many authors anecdotally that this is one of the most frequently invoked grounds when it comes to set-aside or non-enforcement or non-recognition of awards. But the data does not confirm that at all. Indeed, it has the data shows that this particular ground is invoked in only 9.3% of the cases, which is not very much. What was also quite interesting was the success rate of the different grounds. The two most successful grounds here were, first, that the arbitration agreement did not exist or was not inapplicable, and second, that one of the parties did not sign the arbitration agreement. And these were successful in 36.5% and 42% of the cases, respectively. And many others were much less successful, such as, for instance, the substantive validity, which was only successful in 19.3% of the cases. And in that context, what was also quite noteworthy is that there is a certain mismatch between the frequency with which grounds are invoked and the success they hail. So, for instance, for the substantive invalidity that I've just mentioned, it is the most frequently invoked ground, but it has actually a fairly low success rate. So really here, the takeaway for practitioners is maybe to double check the success rate for any particular ground before making a decision on whether or not it should be invoked as frequently as it is in practice. Now, for all of these results, I should say and repeat the one important caveat is that, of course, because of the selection bias, we used the randomly selected cases in the Wolters Kluwer database, and I would be interested whether our results are confirmed if one were to look at a different data set, but that still needs to be tested. So, Monique, let me now ask you again a question, turn back to you, and ask you about another ground for non-enforcement or set-aside, and one that is often discussed and concerns the violation of international public policy. You addressed this point in the special issue, so can you tell us a bit more about the details of your findings?
So first of all, we will make the data set available to everybody. I still do not know how all of this will be done in practice, but usually every empirical research has the data set publicly available. And so that all the data that we coded, that will be there. And then we plan to redo this in 5 years and see what has happened. Of course, the problem on one hand that we have is also to address the selection bias. So what do we, for example, for setting us up for enforcement of awards in France, the conclusion of Dr. Knoll Tudor was that the data set that we had was not representative of the approach in for recognition and enforcement in France. So on one hand, we don't want to have a too selective approach as far as data that are input in the Kluwer data set. On the other hand, I find that the new attitude of putting everything online and putting all these court proceedings there without somebody overlooking and seeing if they're relevant or not, if they're interesting to practitioner in international arbitration, would just reach an opposite effect, because what happens is that in the Kluwer database will be difficult to search by word, and so would be just too many cases, which then become, because there are too many, not properly searchable. So the idea is to reach a balance between, on one hand, having all the relevant cases, and on the other hand, don't putting too much of what I would say noise. There are noise cases there, just to say, well, we have that many cases, because that's really not the point. I mean, the point is that the Kluwer, the Wolters Kluwer database should really have the most important decision in international commercial arbitration. And this decision should be coming from several jurisdictions and not just a handful, but we're talking about 74 jurisdictions, so that you have a broad spectrum of a jurisdiction represented there in order really to run an empirical research on the word, the court judgment in commercial arbitration. Thank you.
Thank you, Monique, for all your insights. This has been really very rich in terms of what we have learned from the data that you have collected and coded and worked with in international commercial arbitration for this special issue of the Journal of International Arbitration. So thank you very much for sharing all your knowledge and thoughts in this episode of the podcast, and we look forward to potentially any updates that you have for future research. Thank you.
Absolutely, Maxi. Thank you very much for running with us with this project. It has been really time consuming and probably at least more difficult than we anticipated at the beginning, but really rewarding. So thank you very much. And thank you to Walter Kluwer for having given us the platform for this research. Thank you.
Stay informed. Subscribe to this podcast. Visit kluwerlaw.com or follow us on social media.